Welcome to Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. I'm Julia Elliott Brown, the founder and CEO of Enter the Arena. I'm a serial entrepreneur and an expert in raising investment and business growth. Our mission at Enter the Arena is to empower female founders to fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business with investment expertise and business coaching. Here we share the stories of inspirational female founders who've raised investment to inspire you to do the same. You'll hear their honest accounts of what it was really like to secure funding, the highs, the lows, and the challenges they experienced on the journey. And along the way, we'll discuss top tips for how you can be successful too. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Vinita Tripathi, the founder of Vitarka Therapeutics. Vitarka Therapeutics is a biotech startup developing technology to unleash the power of RNA therapeutics, a new class of medications, which will help combat untreated late-stage cancers. Now, Vinita founded the company in 2021 after working for over 15 years in drug development in major pharmaceutical companies. To date, she's raised £800,000 from angels, VCs, and through grant funding. Now, I'm not even going to attempt to explain exactly what Vitarka Therapeutics does because I'm absolutely sure that Vinita will do a much better job of it. So let's meet Vinita and find out more about her innovative biotech startup, how she's raised funding to date, and the challenges she's overcome along the way. So welcome, Vinita.
Thank you very much, Julianne. That was a staggering, impressive introduction. It is really good to hear about Vitarka from someone else. So as you described, what we are doing is we are unleashing the power of RNA therapeutics. So one thing that COVID-19 has taught us that mRNA or RNA therapeutics have the power to bring drugs into the market. However, for late stage cancers, this has not been translating into clinic because of two problems. The existing delivery technologies cannot target to the tumor. And those which do target, they cannot release the RNA into the cytosol. So let me give you a brief analogy. Say you've got a glass vase, which you want to send to a friend. For this, you need to protect the glass so that it doesn't break in the post stage, and therefore you need to wrap it with a bubble wrap. You need the right postal address for your friend's house, and it needs to be delivered inside to the recipient. RNA is like the glass vase. It needs to be protected. That is one of the elements of our technology. The right postal address is the cell surface targeting that we do specifically to specific tumor cells. And then the delivery to the recipient is what our technology does by forming pores in a subcellular compartment. It delivers the RNA into the cytosol where it's required. So that is what we do. The benefit of our technology is that we deliver up to 80% of the cargo of the therapeutic into the cytosol as compared to less than 1% that current technologies can achieve. So that's a significant improvement.
Wow, that's incredible. 80%. And I do understand it now. Thank you. I'm hoping that my glass vase is not broken when it arrives through the post. And can you tell us what RNA stands for, so that for us uninitiated?
So RNA stands for ribonucleic acid. And basically everything that we see in our body, so the color of my hair is because of a protein that makes my hair black. However, that protein's information is held in a DNA, which actually then transcribes into RNA and then into the protein. So the current therapeutics, almost 80% that we have in all the different diseases, are either small molecules, which kind of work to bind to this protein and make it function the right way, or as antibody therapeutics. However, what RNA can do is go back down to the original signature, which makes the protein. So it is almost a long-term, once-and-done type of therapeutic that you can achieve rather than having to take multiple injections.
Wow, impressive. So, okay, how on earth did you discover this? What was the kind of, where were you? What was happening? How did you come across this whole new technology?
So my work previously has been in big pharma, and I really, really enjoyed all the job roles that I've done. And I then stumbled upon and identifying new targets for developing therapeutics. And the way the pharma world is changing is that there is a lot more innovation that's happening outside of pharma, in academic labs, in SMEs, and the startup ecosystem is really booming. So I thought, let's set myself a challenge. I was still comfortable in my pharma job. Let's set myself a challenge, start a company. And initially, we actually got started with developing the RNA therapeutics. Very quickly realized that delivery is actually a major problem. There are loads of companies who are developing the RNA cargo or the payload, as we can call it. But very few who have delivery technologies. So this was a major problem in the market, a major bottleneck as to why drugs are not reaching to the patients. My background from a scientific perspective has been developing delivery technologies. So this is where I thought, why not put the knowledge to use and bring drugs to the untreated patients?
Amazing. But what made you want to actually set up your own company? Had you always dreamed of being an entrepreneur, or was it about having more control, or was it about making more money instead of being salaried? What was it that drove you to that?
So money's definitely never been a motivation. And one of the things is great is that this is what the team believes as well. We know that the money will follow where there's good science. So the motivation was science. And I would say to some extent, I did feel that in big pharma, good ideas can sometimes be lost. Rightly so. We have to follow very stringent processes. However, this means that before a good idea reaches senior management for a decision making, it's already 6 months, 9 months. And this was, I would say, one of the triggers. I felt that a startup company is more lean, agile business. And initially, I was probably a bit naive. I thought fundraising would be not that challenging, as this is what I was doing in big pharma. I would have a project idea, present it to senior management, request 3 million, 5 million for the project, 10 FTEs, and we would get the project running. Of course, SME, a startup company, is quite different to that. But I would say the trigger was that I was sitting on a really good idea, and I didn't want it to get lost in the huge world of big pharma. And so I thought, let me try this out. Fortunately, we had support from investors to get started.
That's amazing. All right. So let's talk about that support from investors. So you've got this idea, this concept, you set up a company. How do you go about securing your first fundraise to help you with that R&D in the biotech space? What did you do?
So I was joined on the journey by our chairman, Martino Picardo, from day one. We had been interacting and we knew each other. And the moment I shared with him I want to do this, he said, I'll be the chairman. I will be very honest. It's only recently I realized how difficult it can be to have a good chairman mentor in the company. So I think I was just really, really lucky. Through Martino, we developed an investment strategy and we made a list of investors that we would be speaking to, mainly people from within our network and whose portfolio, whose values are aligned with what we were developing. So we took that approach. We spoke to very specific investors. So it was about the quality of what they offered and what was already on their portfolio rather than just quantity that I'll speak to 100 investors. Mayer Schreiber was one of the investors, and Discovery Park Ventures was had come up with the new fund that they wanted to invest in businesses, mainly within the gene therapy sector, and also attract businesses to set up in Discovery Park. We were aligned because these were both the things that we were doing. We are a gene therapy company and we were looking for lab space, and I was impressed with the lab space available at Discovery Park. So that's where we started the interaction, and Mayer and Martino were the first investors in the company.
Amazing. So Discovery Park, tell me more about Discovery Park. What is it? Where is it? What do they do?
So Discovery Park is located in Kent, and this is a bit surprising that we even need to talk about that, because if I had said Oxford or Cambridge, this question would not have come up. So it is really great that you've asked this question. It gives me an opportunity to make other founders think beyond the Golden Triangle, beyond London, Cambridge, Oxford. Of course, these are the hubs. These are the universities with the top rating research. However, there are parks, science parks outside of that. Discovery Park is one of them. It's located in Kent. It is an old Pfizer site in Sandwich. And I think I can safely say that almost 10% of Pfizer small molecule discoveries have come from the Discovery Park site before they closed down. It is an impressive site. I am not probably the right person to go into the square footage area of the site, but I would definitely encourage scientific, agricultural, technology founders to put that on their list for setting up the company. What Mayer and Martino and Jane Kennedy, who is the business development lead at Discovery Park, are doing, they're bringing together an ecosystem which is supported not just with startup companies, but also supports in terms of accounts, legal, IT. So all of those external infrastructure that is required is there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I think probably because I'm in the startup space and not specifically in the kind of biosciences space, that's perhaps why I haven't heard of it, but it's really good to know. And when you were having those conversations with Discovery Park Ventures, you know, what kind of challenges did you get from them around your proposition? Where did they test you on whether this was an investable idea?
So the one thing that they did not test me, I'll start with that, is the team. Mayer and Martino truly believed in my abilities to bring a team together. And we have a really strong team. The core expertise of the team is to be to integrate and bring in a network. So that's one thing that they didn't ask me much about. The science is something that we delve a lot on. And this is mainly because the way I was telling the story was too scientific. I was too technical. I am a scientist in my heart and soul, even though I'm a CEO of a company. And I think the moment I was able to break down the science with an analogy, just like I did today, it just was like made sense. I guess that was probably the only thing. I think the second thing, and this is not a challenge I had from Mayer and Martino, but I have had from a few other investors, is that we are not a spin-out company. So it's difficult for them to understand, where are we rooted? Does this team really hold the credibility? But I think since we've had Mayer and Martino on board, that credibility has come in because of the confidence they have shown in me as leading the company, as well as within the team that we have brought together, has really brought in that credibility.
Yeah, I mean, team is so critical, isn't it, that early stage, because you're the ones that are going to take this forward and make it a success, especially when you're just at idea stage. If you have an idea but no team, that's going to be quite challenging. So very clever that you had that team around you. Okay, so what did that initial funding enable you to do then, Vanita? So it's quite a small amount of funding to start with. I think it was 150,000, wasn't it? How far does that get you in the R&D world?
So not very far when you're doing therapeutic development. However, we've used a very smart approach. So along with that funding, we also got support from University of Hertfordshire's European Regional Development Fund, which is a European grant funding. So we were able to hire a postdoc at University of Hertfordshire to do some pilot proof of concept work. So instead of going into a full-blown big pharma-like project, we broke down the technical plan into smaller chunks, and we generated our proof of concept data. Along the same time, we also started continuing applying for grants. We have received another Innovate UK grant, which has obviously progressed the technical plan even further. And we then applied for accelerator programs. So being selected on the Shauna Sullivan's IndieBio program, which is a New York-based program, has really given that impetus that the rocket's now flying. You know, we've taken off even more.
At this point in the podcast, I just want to take a quick moment to talk with you directly about something that I think is really going to help you if you're thinking about raising investment. One of the favourite parts of what I do is talking with the amazing female founders on this podcast, hearing their success stories that honestly inspires me to do what I do. Now, the unfortunate truth is that when it comes to raising investment to grow and scale our businesses, the success stories of women are far and few between when compared to male founders. Call it what you want, but we are calling it out. My brand new book, Raise, The Female Founder's Guide to Securing Investment, applies the thousands of female founders' experiences that I've worked alongside, combined with the five key steps to raising investment that I teach our clients at Enter the Arena. And it's specifically tailored to the female founder experience. The reason I wrote this book is to help level the playing field for you, providing you with all the vital information you need to know before, during, and even after securing an investor. So my fellow female founders, it is time to armor yourself, get clued up, and get your business taking flight. You can get the book on Amazon, just type in Raise, The Female Founder's Guide to Securing Investment, and you'll be able to find it there. Right, back to the podcast. So why the USA? Why do an accelerator program in the States? Is that because there wasn't anything appropriate here in the UK? Or is it that you want to, you know, quickly progress your business into the States?
So there are lots of options in the UK. The ecosystem is really fast and growing. However, it is not a hidden fact that there is more investment that happens in the USA, and there is a more risk-taking mindset. So early stage company, especially therapeutic company, yes, it is a high risk, but it is a high reward. So as compared to another company where you might get a 5x return, you can get a 300x return on exit. That was one of the reasons, but the main reason for joining IndieBio is the expertise of the team and the huge network that we could tap into. Moreover, our commercialization strategy is to have B2B sales. So we would partner, collaborate with businesses who have RNA therapeutics but need a delivery technology. And most of these are based in USA. So for us, we realized early on that it would be really good to start having a footprint in USA. We are not moving our operations completely there. We still continue to operate in the UK. Tapping into IndieBio's network, getting that really strong support from them, and starting to develop a footprint in USA while retaining our operations in the UK, that was one of the reasons. I'm really proud of Vitarka's team for what we have achieved. We are the only UK company on IndieBio's cohort, so that's a really proud moment for us.
I bet, really impressive. I mean, and it's interesting you talk about how about this thing about commercializing what you're doing. You're a scientist by background, as you admit. So taking, you know, there's one thing kind of developing a solution, but another thing taking it to market. How have you convinced investors that you could commercialize what you're doing, which at the end of the day is what investors are looking for?
Yes. Yeah, so on the team, we have Peter Simpson, who is the ex-CSO of Medicines Discovery Catapult in the UK. He joined us in the summer. And I think since him joining, our commercialization strategy, our route to market strategy, which already had shape and form, but it got really refined. So Peter was one of the triggers. Also, last year, we were selected on a reactor program, which was delivered by Discovery Park and Uday Fadke Sandots from Triple Chasm model. And we used that Triple Chasm model. We really got into what's the market analysis, what's the gap in the market, what are our distribution channels. And all of this really, really helped us think and define our commercialization strategy. So yes, I'm a scientist. However, I do have a commercial expertise in terms of developing a business case, knowing a target product profile, what would the market look like, etc. But the reactor program and Peter's joining, that kind of really refined and streamlined a route to market strategy.
Your team sounds so instrumental in all of this. And you've managed to attract some really incredible people at a very early stage. How have you managed to do that?
I would say just by being who I am. And from the very get-go, I have been on the lookout for people who share my passion. I'm really passionate. This is like our baby. We want to get this into the market. We want it to grow, but we want it to grow such that we are giving it back to the society. And everyone who has joined me on the journey are people who share the same passion. So yeah, I guess just by being myself, you know, they shared the vision, they bought into the passion, and they want to work the way I'm working, really hard, persevering, not giving up. We are all resilient people. We, you know, on no means we'll do this again and we'll get better at it. So I guess that would be it, you know, just being who you are.
Yeah, and that passion and that resilience, those are such important qualities, aren't they, to be successful as a startup. So let's change tack slightly here. I mean, I'm really interested to know your perspective about whether you felt conscious of your gender or your ethnicity as you were going out to raise investment. And I'm really interested to understand that in the context of your industry, because I don't know whether there is a good gender balance in your industry to start with. So I'd love to hear your views on both of those things.
Yeah, so I would say the answer is yes and no in terms of a fundraising journey. So my work, actually, I started in academia and then moved to Big Pharma. And both of those places, there's always a lot of talk about gender bias. So in academia, the gender bias happens where women are able to get to a certain position but cannot progress beyond to, say, a professorship or being a head of the department. In industry, it's slightly different. Even when you are able to progress to a leadership position, which I fortunately was, there is a disparity when it comes to salary, compensation, and several other things. In fundraising journey, I would say 90% of the investors I have engaged with have looked beyond my gender and ethnicity. However, there were that 10% who made me realize I'm brown and female. So being in a professional world for 20 years and this was a major shock. I've never actually related myself as being a female or a brown leader. I'm a leader. That's it, you know. I don't need to be labeled, but definitely I did feel that, you know, there were more questions asked, there were more things about where do you come from? And I'm like, I come from the UK. I've been here more than half my life. Yes, I do have a different accent, which is probably not going to go. So I did suddenly see myself in the mirror and I felt I'm not just a leader, I'm a brown female leader. Part of this, I think, is also embedded in the fact that 95% of investors are male. I have to date spoken only to 5% female investors. And I would say that, you know, the number of investors we've spoken to is very slowly getting into three-digit numbers. That is a substantial disparity in the investor world in terms of gender that exists. But as I said, 90% have looked beyond my race, gender, and just looked at the science and the commercialization strategy and the team.
I mean, it's interesting when you compare the world of academia and the world of being in a big corporate compared to the world of investment. For me, it seems that there's a lot more structure and discipline and rules and regulations around bias in those two places where you were previously. That my sense is that that doesn't exist enough in the investment ecosystem. So people can behave in ways that they want to without any accountability usually. And I think that's part of the issue. But I'm also encouraged to hear that you've actually found only maybe 10% of your interactions did make you feel conscious of your gender and ethnicity. I mean, you talk about kind of questions that you got asked, which made you feel that. Can you remember any specifics around that? What exactly was it that made you feel perhaps you were being treated a little differently?
Questions around the science, questions around my ability of being able to execute the science. Not going on to brag about myself, but I have 13 patents. I've published in several eminent journals like Science, Nature. I co-discovered a gene called TDP43 mutation. Now an entire disease is known by that, right? And that's impacted 50 million patients worldwide. Still being asked very granular questions about, can you do this assay? Are you sure you are doing the right thing? Was a bit like, really? Do I have to explain that? I think the other part was in terms of, can you balance it? And I was like, with what? Because there is this unspoken definition, you are a woman, you are a mother, will you be able to have it all? And my response is, why do I need to have it all? My husband, who is also father, doesn't get asked that. So I think that's those were the kind of challenges. And I think the commercialization was another question, because how could you understand numbers? I'm like, but it's a numbers game. If I'm fundraising and if I'm expecting someone to put trust and belief in the company, in me and in the team, give me $500,000 or £500,000, then it is my responsibility. I'm accountable to make sure that grows from $500,000 to $10 million to $20 million. So if I didn't understand numbers, I wouldn't be presenting. I wouldn't take on that task to myself. So I think it was, can you deliver on the technical aspects? Will you be able to do it all? Do you really understand the numbers you're talking about? It was around those specific sections.
Your credentials are clearly very impressive. It's interesting, actually, before this interview, I was talking with your PR team and they sent over some information about you. And interestingly, none of those credentials were in your bio. And now I know about these patents that you have, that you've created and own, it raises your level so much more. So I think getting that stuff up front is so important. And I'm glad you managed to deal with those questions with investors. And again, the question of balance is an interesting one, isn't it? Even when we don't get asked those questions directly, I think sometimes there is that unconscious bias which is sitting behind an investor's thought process. They may not ask you the question directly, but they may well be thinking it, and we will never really know that. But it's something we have to keep fighting for and question, I think, when people ask us those questions. As you say, they don't ask them of the guys. So, I mean, what do you think you would do differently if you could start your fundraise again?
So I think one thing that I would do differently is learn how to storytell. And as you just said very rightly, talk about the credentials, not just myself, but of the team. For some reason, and I guess this is just a personality thing, not about me being a female or being brown, that I always shy away from talking about, look how great the team is, because I just feel, yeah, we've done this. That is our job. This is what we have. I wake up every day because I want to get a drug to the patient. So the patents, publications, that's part of my job. That's part of why I'm living. So one thing that I would definitely do differently is start bringing and talking more about the team. I have seen some of my male counterparts who do that, even though they don't actually have those credentials for the team. And the second thing is, I would learn storytelling. Even when I thought that I was breaking down the science to a very basic biology level, like an A levels, I can now understand how complicated it is, because the human body is complicated. Cancer is complicated. These are really complex diseases, and we are developing complex therapeutics. So I would definitely learn storytelling as a communication style.
So much involved with fundraising, isn't there? There's the communication skills, the financial skills, business strategy, negotiation. It's a lot, but you've obviously done a great job of all of it. So, you know, that's great. What do you think we could be doing in the industry to get more female founded businesses out there? What do you think needs to change?
So this might sound quite contradictory to the question, but the first thing I think we need to do is stop saying female founder. Founder, full stop. And my reason for saying this is that, you know, I'm a great fan of Malcolm Gladwell and quite a few of his books, as well as Daniel Goleman. So emotional intelligence and subconscious thinking is something that I've read quite extensively about. There is a test called an implicit association test, and I would actually encourage all your listeners to have a look at that test. I've done that test myself. And what that test basically demonstrates is that when, say, I'm going for an interview, and if I'm asked to fill in an equality and diversity form, subconsciously, it's already giving me a disadvantage because there are these biases that exist in the society which have primed our brain to think a certain way for, say, a brown, a black, a white person, a male or a female person, and therefore it would already put me at a disadvantage. So the moment we say female founder and you go into a pitch, subconscious, at a very granular subconscious level, you've already put yourself at a disadvantage. Because women are expected not to be confident. You're expected to be that mother who's at home. You're expected to be the person who is shy. If you're confident, it's always sometimes gets perceived as, oh my God, that was too bold and too brutal. You're just confident. So the moment you use the word or label someone, that's what happens. In practice, at the macro level, the culture, the mindset needs to change at board level and trickle down. It's a top-down trickling of the mindset that needs to happen, especially more in the investors' boards, I would say, rather than the company boards. I mean, there are many female founders. The Indie Buyer cohort is 50-50. Half of us are female founders, and in fact, a fully female teams as well. In the startup world, I think the companies have already got some of those balances, but in the investment world, there probably isn't that balance yet.
Mm. I love what you say about the kind of, if we label ourselves in a certain way, it makes us behave in a certain way. And I totally agree with that. I think there's a danger of us looking at some of the statistics around how little funding goes to female founders. And then we go into these interactions with a chip on our shoulder, expecting to be attacked in some way and instantly being on the defensive, which I think can be quite destructive, actually. And I agree, you know, I think we should not go out there trying to raise investment because we're a female founder and you should invest in me because I'm a female founder. That's I'm not a believer in quotas at all.
I fully agree with you. You know, invest in us because we are doing great science and we are going to get drugs to the patients, not because I'm a female founder. I fully 100% agree with you.
Yeah. So when you have made this business an incredible success and exited your business for millions or billions, will you be making that commitment to be one of those female investors and put your money back into the ecosystem? Do you see yourself doing that in the future?
Yes, absolutely. I do see myself. And let's assume, fingers crossed, we do get to the millions and billions. But regardless of that, I would still continue championing. You know, I'm a mother to a daughter, and I grew up in India, where it's funny that I would say I was so lucky that I had education, but I was, that I had education as a girl child in the family and had the best of the education. That was 25 years ago. And I do not see that the world has changed that much for my daughter. So in the next 20 years, I definitely want to make sure that at least I am part of bringing about that change so that our children, son and daughter, have equality. They don't have to go out there thinking, are we brown? Am I a man? Am I a woman? We just shouldn't have the need to think about any of those external aspects. It should be about what's in the head, what's in the heart, what's in the soul.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, I mean, that change comes top down when you look at the world of investment, but also it starts right at the beginning, from the minute our children are born, how we treat our children, whether they, you know, in terms of their gender, how we encourage them with their ambition, their choice of education subjects. I mean, getting more women into STEM is a big issue. And when we can see that coming through from the bottom and we see that change coming from the top, then maybe we have some hope of closing the gender gap in our lifetime. Let's hope so. Thank you so much for your insights. It's been really, really interesting. And we look forward to watching your journey. Please do stay in touch. And we wish you all the best. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you so much, Julie. I really enjoyed the conversation. And I really hope that I can be part of, small part of the change to bring about the equality for everybody.
Thanks for following Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. This content is all provided to you for free. So if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe so you never miss another one. Enter the Arena has helped hundreds of female founders fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business. Our first-hand experience, expert guidance, and proven programs help female founders unleash the Wonder Woman inside. To see if we can help you do the same, head over to www.enterthearena.co.uk. I'm Julia Elliott-Brown, and I look forward to talking with you soon.